Okay, it's.
Oh, darn it.
Okay, it's June 10th, 2008. We're meeting Professor Turifalco in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So, as I said, we'd like to begin at the very beginning. So, can you tell us the basic information about yourself, when and where you were born, and onward?
Well, my birthday is there. It's July 3rd, 1928, okay, in New York. Left when I was very young.
In the city?
My parents moved out of New York City, ultimately settled in Central Jersey, went to school at Rutgers, undergraduate work.
And I see that you majored in chemistry.
I did. I majored in chemistry. I had decided that I wanted to be a scientist when I was about 12 years old, because I had read a number of popularizations, scientific popularizations. They were very exciting. And before going to college, I had some jobs that were interesting. I worked for Ortho, which at that time was a very small outfit. I was fortunate enough to be there when Oroshnik, who synthesized vitamin A, was there, and Levine, who worked on the RH factor, was also there. The summer before I went to school, I worked for Merck in a pilot plant for antibiotics. Streptomycin had been discovered by Waksman at that time, and Merck was trying to produce it. So I majored in chemistry. After leaving there, I was looking for something to do. But by the way, I knew very little about colleges or departments or science, any of that stuff, because I was the first one to go to college. Neither my mother nor father did. My father was born in Calabria, and my mother was born in New York, but I was the first one to go on to school. I knew nothing about the system. The first thing I did was to take a fellowship in the Rutgers Agriculture School in the food technology department, and I was working on the biochemistry of beef. I got disenchanted with that after a year or so because there wasn't enough mathematics or molecular physics in it, so I switched over to chemical physics, moving to the University of Cincinnati. Of course, I knew nothing at all about the schools. I was just lucky to go into the University of Cincinnati because at that time they had a truly outstanding faculty because so many people from government projects like Los Alamos were looking for university jobs. So I even took electrodynamics from Podolsky, okay, and people of his caliber in the other fields. At last, at Cincinnati, I think for about 10 years, but I was there. And they were trying, the idea of interdisciplinarity was okay at Cincinnati. And that's where I first learned of it, because I was in a department called the Applied Science Department, whose mission was to bring together different disciplines to focus on projects. This was even before ARPA. Unfortunately, they had a strange idea of doing it. Their idea of doing it was to make sure that you got everything in math, physics, and chemistry that the mathematicians, physicists, and chemistry got, and you had to take three qualifiers. So I don't have much patience with students today to say they're overworked. So I left Cincinnati, went to work for DuPont. I only stayed there 8 or 9 months because I looked around and I didn't want to do what they were doing. I was looking at what they were 5 and 10 years people doing there, and I didn't want to be like that. So I went to work for NACA, which I had previous job offer, at the Lewis Flight Propulsion Laboratory in Cleveland. And while I was there, the NACA was converted to NASA. I was in a solid-state physics group there, did a lot of research on diffusion and defects in crystals, became head of solid-state physics section. And in 1961, I got a call from Pennsylvania asking me if I would want to come as associate professor to this department. I said yes, and I've been there ever since. What else can I tell you?
A career in a nutshell type. So a lot of the people who choose chemistry like to tell a particular episode that they had in their youth about how they first got interested in chemistry or science.
The first thing was a chemistry set. And of course, I was only 12, didn't know what to do with it. But I was very much interested in what things were made of. And I had read books like The New World of Chemical Discovery. Who was the author of that? I don't remember. But he wrote two books. One was The New World of Chemical Discovery. The other one was The New World of Physical Discovery. And I created a basement lab in which I did things like make esters and dyes and extracted stuff from mint plants and a lot of youthful chemical experiments. So I did a lot of organic chemistry in my basement, and so it seemed very natural. Besides, I didn't know much. I didn't know, for example, I thought I had a major in chemical engineering. It came as a surprise to me when I found out I could actually major in just chemistry. I didn't have to be an engineer. So I was very naive. It was a great choice. A great choice, because in physical chemistry, you learn a great many things that physicists never really master. Like, to this day, I believe that chemists and physical chemists learn thermodynamics in a much better way than physicists do. Because in the chemistry, you have to apply it to a lot of real materials with the phase rule, chemical reactions, and so on. But that's a prejudice. So I don't know if there was an individual event, but it was a natural evolution out of my basement laboratory.
Were your parents a factor in any way? What did they do?
Oh, they were great. I was their shining bright boy, and they let me go ahead, sometimes not realizing that it was dangerous. I remember once had a terrible time because I liberated bromine, and it vaporized and filled the house. Thank God they were away. I spent all afternoon trying to fan bromine out of the windows. But I survived all that. That was one of my unhappy memories.
Okay, so I'm quite interested in this Department of Applied Science that you moved into in Cincinnati.
It was a fascinating department.
So when did this department begin?
I don't know. I arrived there in, I graduated in 50. I arrived there in 51, I guess. And I left in 54. Yeah, 51 to 54. I got a master's and a PhD there.
So,
3 years.
It seems that it looks like a Harvard-type model that they're trying to get at.
Of course I didn't know. And I didn't even know they were trying to break new ground. All I knew was I had to do this work to get the degree. And later on, I realized what they were doing, but I also realized that they should have done it differently. Instead of creating a new curriculum, they simply combined the curricula of other departments.
So tell me a bit more about the overall structure of the department.
Of the department?
Yeah, while you were there.
Well, they had a director. I don't remember if the official name was the School of Applied Science or the Department of Applied Science. I just don't recall. But it was a sizable place. I mean, there were 8 or 10 faculty members and about 100 students. And I thought it was a wonderful place because I was doing research. But I went back many years later, and it was a terrible building. It was old, poorly maintained. Okay. At one time we were spilling over, so it was so crowded, and I moved all of my experiments into a room under the stadium, like Fermi. Okay. So, but there's not much to tell, except that, again, the professors were very good.
And they were from various disciplines.
Well, yes, they were from various disciplines, but they were all members of that department.
Right.
Most of them, we had an organic chemist, and we had a couple of physical chemists, and fellows specialized in surfaces, but those are the ones I remember. I do certainly remember the director, his name was Soller, S-O-L-L-E-R, very energetic, powerful person.
So the school or Department of Applied Science was more oriented toward the chemical sciences than physics?
Well, let me think. More towards physical chemistry, chemical physics. But we had people that were doing, for example, one experiment I thought was fascinating, measuring the adhesion of things to metals. And they would put like a paint dot or something that would stick on a steel ball and spin it in a centrifuge and measure the velocity at which it flew off, so they knew the force it took to get it off. There was a lot of physics involved in that. My own work was on the adhesion of ice to surfaces because it was supported by the Air Force for de-icing, so I did a lot of that. Another was gas flow, a lot of gas flow work going on through powders and membranes. So it was not what I would traditionally expect in a physics department, but looking back on it, there was a lot of physics.
Well, tell me a bit more about your own research during that.
Mine?
Yeah, PhD.
My PhD research. My PhD research was on the adhesion of ice to surfaces. Actually, it was really just the interfacial physics of water and ice with surfaces. The experiments that we did was to dunk powders into water and measure the heat evolved. That's the heat of weighing. I was using a microcalorimeter that was built by a predecessor of mine for which he got a master's degree, extremely sensitive with a 126 junction thermocouple, and sensitive enough so that we, of course, had to take it. What you did was put a powder in a bulb, evacuate it. So you had the powder in an empty evacuated bulb, put it underwater, break the bulb, let water rush in, measure the heat. Okay? But the PV work in the bulb was important. You had to know the volume of the bulb and calculate that. And we found that the limiting factor in the experiment was the strain energy of the glass when you broke it. We had bulbs specially made so that they were uniform, but they weren't perfectly uniform. So the strain energy of the glass varied from one to another. So these were calorimeters that could measure a microdegree differential. So worked all that out and did a number of experiments in which I pre-adsorbed stearic acid on the surfaces. So the stearic acid blocks the active sites. So with partial surface layer, you get a partial heat, and you get a measure of the surface energy distribution over the surfaces. I think the important thing that came out of that was I worked out a theory relating the interfacial tensions and surfaces to the surface tensions and energies. And that has stood the test of time, and those results are still being used. So.
And after your PhD, you quickly moved into solid-state physics. How did that happen?
Right. Well, again, that was a natural evolution. I was working with solids, solid surfaces. And about that time, Fred Seitz had published his great big book, Modern Theory of Solids, which was the first book on solid-state physics that I read. It was the only existing book. You know about that. And I was fascinated by that book. Somehow or other, I got interested in defects, starting from the surfaces, got to point defects. That led me to diffusion. And I continued studying solid-state. And that was it. It seemed like a natural thing.
So your research at NASA was mostly on
point defects and diffusion, right? Both experimental and theoretical. Okay. So I started. I don't know if I was the first, but one of the first to do calculations on the structure around point defects in solids. You know, the relaxation using bad potentials. And eventually I gave up because I knew that those potentials weren't good. But we got a lot of good information out of them. And when I came here, it was obvious that diffusion was important for so many things that were being done. And since I had been interested in point defects, one of the things that led me to it was that I did a set of experiments, and I'm not sure why I ended up with those experiments, at NASA, in which we looked at void growth in silver crystals during plastic deformation. I think I got interested in that because I had heard that plastic deformation increased the number of point defects. I don't remember how I learned that, and so I thought it'd be interesting to look at. And I had a young lady who was a collaborator who did the hard work of measuring the sizes of the voids as a function of time. It was obviously a diffusion problem. So I worked out the theory for how vacancies diffuse to a grain boundary and nucleate to form voids and the void growth and fit the experiments pretty well. And it was really on the basis of that work that I was asked to come to Penn.
So Bob Madden knew about your work.
The reason he knew about it was because I had started a conference, organized a conference in Cleveland. One of the things about Cleveland was it was far away from other centers, and I felt a little bit isolated. So I asked a fellow named Jay Dinas, who was a Brookhaven scientist, to be a consultant. I had met him at Gordon conferences. And he came to be a consultant, and we did a lot of work together, but I still felt that was not quite enough, so I did organize a conference on diffusion, which was a very hot topic at the time. Everybody came. And one of the people that came was Bob Madden, and he listened to my paper on the vacancies in oxides and silver. And he thought that was interesting, and he asked me to come and give a seminar at Penn on it. I came and gave a seminar, and sometime after that, he called me. It's the way things usually happen.
Right. Bob also worked on point defects to some extent, didn't he?
Bob Madden had an interesting scientific history. He seemed to, in several areas, anticipate what the next big thing was going to be. He is not the big name in work hardening, okay? But he wrote a few papers before anybody else was in it about that, okay? And it was important to do that. He did the same thing with strain-enhanced diffusion. Before anybody else was worrying about the enhancement of diffusion by plastic strain, he did some experiments on it. To this day, we don't know if those experiments were correct or not, but it initiated a field. And then he did a high quench, it's a so-called splat cooling. He was, I think, the first one to take metal and cool it so fast that it didn't crystallize, it stayed as a glass. And he called it splat cooling because what he did was very interesting. He had a rotating metal wheel, okay, copper, I think it was, and then he had a bar which was pulled back like a spring, and on it he had a blob of molten metal, and he'd let go, and the thing would shoot across a couple inches of space, hit the wheel, splat out into a thin film, and it was very rapidly quenched. So, and that was really the beginning of the study of metallic glasses. So other people became famous in these things because they stayed with them. But Bob was did several things. Also, he was very busy building a department. You have no idea how much time that takes. Maybe you do. So I thought that was kind of intriguing. And people here were doing stuff for which diffusion was obviously very important. So I continued the work that I had started on diffusion at NASA.
So what was the attraction of Penn for you to move over? Was there an option for you to stay on at NASA?
Yes.
For a while?
I had it made at NASA. I was head of solid state physics section. I didn't have to do anything at run research groups. And everything was nice, but I had always wanted to teach. I thought teaching would be the most really great fun. And also, although I did have self-determination at NASA, it was still government and mission-oriented. And one of the things I liked about universities, you had a greater degree of control over your own work and doing what you wanted to do. And I knew about Penn. I liked Madden. I came and met the people here. They were doing interesting stuff. Philadelphia's a nice place, so I came.
So in 1961, you came to Philadelphia.
Right.
What was the state of the department at the time?
It was really a nucleus department. I think they had, before I came, and some other people came with me about the same time, I think it was about four or five people. And I came in the growth spurt that brought it up to about 10 or 12. They brought in a chemical metallurgist named Jeff Belton, who was a world-class fellow, Erwin Partey, a great crystallographer. Gee, we were all so young then. And of course, they brought in Charlie McMahon, who you may or may not know. So that was the brought in. Who else did they bring in? Gaskell, Dave Gaskell, who was also a chemical metallurgist, but he only left for Purdue.
I think I studied one of his. I think I read one of his textbooks.
Yeah. Well, he has one textbook in many editions, and he moved out to Purdue. They brought in a fellow named Neil Durdaller, who ultimately died in a car accident. Herb Herman, who didn't get tenure, ended up at where did he end up? Some really good university in New York, I think. So I was at the leading edge of the great growth spurt. Doris Wilsdorf was here at the time. She was also already quite famous. Okay.
So I assume that the fact that Penn already had the ARPA grant was a big attraction factor.
Oh, sure, because I was guaranteed support from the word go. Right.
So what was the kind of support that you were guaranteed?
Like what?
So what was the support that you were guaranteed?
Well, the LRSM was supporting my research in diffusion. I didn't have to go for a grant.
Right.
It was here. The LRSM had local grants. They gave out the money. The government would send them a block of money each year, and they would locally give it out with an executive committee. And it was much better then than it is now for several reasons. One is the grant was enough to support a professor. A professor didn't have to go out and get five or six different grants to support a group. The second was that they saw a student through. Once they took on a student, they supported him till the end. Nowadays, students can get cut off anytime because there's not enough money. And the third was there was adequate funds. They provided a lot of great capital equipment. In fact, when I was director of LRSM at the end of the year, I used to get a phone call says we're having capital expenditure, capital equipment money. Do you need any this year? So this was unheard of. I had a director's emergency fund. If somebody was running out of money for something, I could give it to them. Try that today.
So when you first moved into the Penn Metallurgical Engineering Department at the time, where was your office?
In the town building. Okay. Terrible office. Old, paint peeling. Mm-hmm. We were waiting to get in here. But a wonderful time.
So all the department faculty was
all moved over here, yeah.
And I was quite interested in the fact that metallurgy was the only department that moved this entire department within.
Right. Well, there were several reasons for that. One of which, chemistry and physics, of course, were much too big. The other is that all of metallurgy was material science, whereas in chemistry and physics, only part of theirs was material science. However, some people did move over as individuals. We had some physicists and some chemists in this building. They usually kept an office also in their departments, but we had people here that from chemistry and physics that had offices here and worked here and mingled. So there was a good deal of mixing. We had joint seminars all the time, of course. We were the only entire department that moved. Other departments had faculty and laboratories here.
So did the physics and chemistry faculty rotate from time to time, or did they just stay on while?
It was pretty stable. I mean, the ones that were in this building?
Right.
Yeah, it was pretty stable because you choose an area of research, you don't change it every year.
Right, but my understanding is that individual faculty members had to submit a proposal to the executive committee of the
That's
LRSM,
correct. That's
and
correct.
They approve or not approve.
That's correct.
That depending on the topic.
Right.
So if faculty member A was doing good work and then he submitted another proposal and that got denied, did he have to move he or she?
He wasn't forced to. I mean, next year he might submit one that was. Okay. The faculty kept pretty close touch with what was needed and what was going on because it was always a topic of discussion. The executive committee had a representative from each department on it. So the representative from our department, for example, would come back to departmental meetings and say, this is the direction the LRSM is going, this is what physics is doing, this is what chemistry is doing, what these individuals are doing. That's for your information if you want to submit proposals.
So do you feel that maybe you're not the perfect person to answer this question since you came in at 61 after all things have been figured out to some extent and it was already on its
way? I'm going to say that again?
The question that I had was there a substantial difference in the practice of doing research before and after LRSM came into being at Penn? For example, were there more collaboration among faculty members from different departments?
The LRSM created collaboration in many ways where there had been none. The departments are very insular at universities usually. Maybe Penn was a little better than others, but I don't think a whole lot. I talked about Illinois because that was the only example I knew. where there was a close collaboration between physics and metallurgy. But departments didn't know what was going on in other fields. For example, physics departments knew about and mathematics departments knew about dislocation theory, even though they weren't using it or doing it. On a visit to Russia at one time, I found that the metallurgists did not know dislocation theory because they were so separated from math departments and physics departments. And in the early days, these were mathematical problems. Right? And they were so separated from mechanical engineering problems and so on, issues that nobody had told them about dislocation theory. They didn't even read each other's journals. Nevertheless, the LRSM, over a period of time, created a system of collaboration that was much, much greater than had ever existed before at Penn. My opinion is that other universities would tell you the similar thing. The ones that we were most like was Cornell, and I know that was true for Cornell. I had friends there. So, from that point of view, the ARPA program was an enormous success. It was also very successful from a research point of view, but from the systemic point of view of how science was done, it was very successful.
Would there be any way to measure that, in your view? Or is it just a...
Well, there is a way to measure, but it requires too much work. You can look at all of the papers that are published and see who the authors are.
Right. And see how they cross-fertilize.
Right. I don't know if ARPA or National Science Foundation has kept statistics on that, but it would be an interesting question to ask. Find the person who's responsible for these things now at the National Science Foundation, and ask them if they have any knowledge of statistics. In fact, there's a guy in town you might want to call about this, Joe Bordogna.
How do you spell his name?
B O R D O. G-N-A. Okay? He's an electrical engineer, but for a number of years he was a deputy director of NSF. He just came back to Penn a few years ago. He was from our electrical engineering department. He was a dean here, and he would know if there's any measurement made of the degree of interdisciplinarity. And you can get his... You could ask Pat for his number. She could track it down for you. Or you could look him up. You can Google him and find his CV.
Because the reason that I'm asking this is when people, as I've been searching information about LRSM, what people usually cite as a prime example of interdisciplinary research at LRSM is the... Alan Heeger, Alan McDiarmid collaboration, which led to the Nobel
Prize.
Well,
that is a prime example, and it's there because they got the prize, right? Okay? But there were many others.
But when I, and you say that there are many others, but when I went through looking at the archives, at the Penn archives under the stadium, as your office was like in Cincinnati, maybe. The system was that individual faculty members submit proposals to LRSM.
That's correct.
So I was thinking that might rouse an interest in the field of material science broadly.
Right.
But that doesn't necessarily promote collaboration among faculty.
Well, there are various definitions of collaboration, right? An important factor... which does not involve person-to-person collaboration, is that people are opened up to what's happening in other fields. So our students took quantum theory from physics department. Our students take courses in the chemistry department. Right now, I think there's more collaboration than there ever has been. You take our polymer people and our theoretical people at VTech, they work with people in other departments all the time. A great collaboration has been between Campbell Laird and mechanical engineering, John Bassani. Jack Fisher, his collaboration with the physics people like Johnson and Maley and many others is terrific. I mean, the nanotube field has in fact resulted in a number of publications in which are people from different departments. I myself have published a paper in which my name exists with that of Paul Heine from physics. So the collaboration is real. Person to person grew over a period of time, as you would expect. It's not going to be instantaneous. People have to get to know each other, right? But I can tell you from observation that regardless of any objective data you try to generate, or stories you hear beyond McDiarmid and Heger, this broadening has been very real, and collaboration one way or another has been very, very real. And I think an amazingly powerful development in American science.
Yeah, Professor Madden talked about the weekly tea time that you had? There was a tea time within the lab?
Yeah, we all used to be down there. Uh-huh. Now, here's another one for you, okay? We had a faculty member named Solomon Pollock. He's retired now. He and I were good friends. His research specialty was thin films. One day he decided that he was going to study biomaterials. This was before the big bio explosion. So he did that. And he ended up working with a fellow in orthopedics named Carl Brighton. And one of the things he was looking at was the electropotentials generated by stress in bones. A practical result of that, by the way, was that putting electrodes on bones in old people accelerated the healing. It was a collaboration, extra-departmental collaboration that has had historic influence here at Penn. We now have a bioengineering department in Penn. Essentially, without Pollock, it would, and his work would not have existed, even though there was things called bioengineering before, which is really looking at X-ray tubes and things of that sort. But the collaboration with the medical part is all came out of the LRSM idea of interdisciplinarity. Okay? So that's the kind of thing that you won't get if you do what I say, look at papers in material science. Right. It goes beyond that. We had a fellow working on dental materials, which, by the way, was first initiated by Hofstetter, who went and taught dental materials in the School of Dentistry. Okay? You can't get much more interdisciplinary than that.
Right.
Okay? So I don't think those things would have happened if there had not been an LRSM, because there was no philosophical focus for such a thing.
Right. So how was John Hofstetter as a director?
Magnificent. John Hofstetter was magnificent in everything he did. He was a superior person. He ended up being vice provost for research at the university. He created the modern research policy for the university.
So, and how would you characterize that, the modern?
Beg your pardon?
How would you characterize the modern research policy for the year?
Oh, it's very enlightened, very straightforward. You know, we had trouble because there was a government program here that had some secrecy to it many, many years ago, and it was under criticism. And we looked and find the university didn't have any standard policy for research. So we created a policy for that stressed openness, stressed academic responsibility, and allowed for some secrecy for patent purposes for a limited time, like a year, could not do any work that required continuing security hiding it. No way. So it's a very good policy. And it has offshoots like what you do with patents and income from it and so on. But it's all written down someplace. You can find it if you want. But he was the originator of that. And he was a great director because he established the policies by which the LRSM functioned to this day. He set up the executive committee. He set up the reporting system. Okay? And the reason he was good for this is because he had the most integrative mind that I had ever met. On anything, he could bring together all the knowledge and coalesce it into an integrated whole. I have a famous paper of his. He didn't publish a lot. But I had a famous paper of his on point defects in semiconductors. And you look at it now and say, oh, yeah, sure, that's all pretty standard stuff. But he created it by bringing together a lot of different things. So he was ideal director for the LRSM. Bob Madden brought him here. I don't know if he realized just how good he would be at it, but he brought him here. And Hofstadter set up. He helped design this building. It was his idea to have a core and a ring around it.
Yeah, I was always interested in his career that he came from Bell Labs.
That's right. Bob brought him here from Bell Labs.
From the metallurgy division.
That's right. He was a metallurgist. But what a metallurgist. I mean, he read and knew everything. He absorbed everything.
And in his obituary, it says, if I remember correctly, he acted as a liaison between the metallurgy group and the physics group within Bell Labs.
And chemistry. Oh, and Bell Labs. I knew a little bit about that, but not much. I knew nothing of his career at Bell Labs. But he sure was a liaison here among everybody.
Right.
And one reason that he could do that was very highly respected because he was so smart. He could understand anything you told him.
I'm really sorry that I can't meet him now.
Oh, it's a shame.
Yeah.
Yeah, he retired, and his last few years he was quite ill. He had balance problems and kidney problems, and I used to go see him a couple times a semester, and it was sad to watch him deteriorate, to see a great mind like that.
So when Hofstadter went on to become vice provost, you took over.
Yeah.
And was it?
I think I was the second. Right. What year was that? I'll tell you.
67.
67. So, yeah, I think that's right. I think I was next. I was the second director. Right.
So, how did that happen? Did someone just give you the offer, or?
Yeah, they set up a committee. As the usual way they do make appointments at universities, they set up a search committee, and which I had no knowledge of. I was ignoring pretty much all that stuff because I was busy. And one day they came and said, well, how would you do this? I said, sure, why not? Because I admired Hofstadter, and I saw that the LRSM was important. And in those days, it was an easy job. It wasn't a hard job.
Because everything had been already set up.
Not only was it already set up, but all you had to do was write your reports every year and do good science. No politicking, no fighting for funds, no visiting Washington every other day.
And how is the relationship between the university and ARPA? Was it hands-off, mostly policy? that ARPA took, or did they try to gain some level of control over what?
Their control was through the annual reports and through a site visit. Okay? And then they rated how you were doing and compared you to the other laboratories and other universities how you were doing. Otherwise, they were hardly ever involved. Every once in a while, there would be a government conference, I guess, on what was important for the future. And you know, there were commissions that were set up to try to analyze where science was and where it was going. Fred Seitz and others had a thing called a solid state panel, of which I was a member. And they would get together a couple times a year and try to sort out what was needed in solid state. Okay. And of course, everybody read those things and was influenced by them. But at the end of the year, you submitted your report to ARPA and later NSF, set up your budget, ask for a certain amount of money, and then you got notified as to what you were getting. After that, the executive committee took that money and distributed it. Now, don't misunderstand, in the budget you did have a statement of what the kind of research you were doing and where it was going to go and who the faculty members were, all the usual stuff. But that was the mechanism of government oversight. Site visits and the report.
So did they in any way try to steer the direction of a particular
sometimes,
topic of research?
Sometimes. So, but in those days, you got to remember that the community included the government people. Okay? It was much less adversarial than it is now. And the reason it's adversarial because it is now is because money's short. And so these guys in Washington have to satisfy a huge number of constituencies. So they got to be very careful in questioning everything. We had people from material science departments take 3-year leaves and go to work for ARPA, running the programs, and later NSF, running the programs. Because in addition to the big report, there were little reports, smaller reports, and continual contact. It's not that they were deaf and dumb until the end of the year. They were part of the system.
So I was trying to understand how this whole budget thing works at the lab.
Now?
Back then.
Oh, back then?
So you get a huge chunk of money from ARPA.
Right, which we asked for specific research directions.
Okay. So and how does the individual faculty proposals fit into that?
The individual faculty wrote up what he wanted to do, sent it to the executive committee. The members of the executive committee read it. Okay, they had discussions and sometimes arguments among themselves as to how much money to allocate for different areas of research. Okay, then they would put a stamp of approval on the ones they chose, notify the faculty member, and he'd go to work. It was all fairly rapid compared to today's lengthy processes.
So the individual faculty proposals has to fit into one of the areas that the lab had proposed to ARPA for doing?
Yes, with an exception. There was always room for new initiatives. And they were labeled new initiatives. Okay? But don't forget, the faculty members were the ones that put the information into what areas of research they were going to go to. So it was no surprise to the executive committee when they got a proposal from a faculty member saying, I want to do this.
So the lab proposal that you submit to ARPA was produced by a bottom-up?
Yeah, oh, of course. Of course, always bottom-up. I mean, no. You can't do it from top-down. Nobody's that smart.
Right.
Except, of course, our president.
Okay. Okay, so you submit the proposal to ARPA, and then in the following year, you accept proposals to fit those those objectives that you set.
Most of which have already been written, right? Because it would,
that's interesting.
Okay. How else would you do it? What would be an alternative system?
I mean, I'm interested in that two-tier system, right? That perhaps the other way might be just accept proposals and kind of collate them into a whole and then submit that to ARPA. But you're saying that there was a kind of a filtering process at the executive committee level that...
Yeah, the director did not submit this report in a vacuum. With the executive, they knew exactly what was going on in the laboratory. They knew what everybody's research was. They discussed their research in the executive committee meetings. There were presentations made of the research. One of the first things I did when I came here was to present my research. There were site visits where we had people come from ARPA who come and listen to these presentations. Everybody knew what was going on. And when things were phased out, they were phased out over a period of time. And they were phased out because other more exciting work was going on. Often by the people that were being phased out.
Right. So it's a fairly organic process that we're...
It's a bottoms-up process. Bottoms-up administration, because the executive committee was chosen by the faculty and the departments. They were there to do the organizing, the collating, to do the dog work. You know. And there were sometimes the decisions that had to be made, okay, because they didn't have enough money for what everybody wanted to do and how to support this instead of that. And sometimes it was a little bit unhappy, as for example, when we go through a transformation from one area of research to another, when we got big into surfaces, other things had to slow down and go. But you know, it was gradual, it was a period of time, and everybody knew what was happening. It wasn't like General Motors, where a guy comes out and says, okay, tomorrow you guys are doing surface chemistry.
So it seems that the way that you describe that period during the 1960s is something like the good old days.
You know what? That's the way I think of them. And I don't know how much of this is simply because I'm old, but there was a very, if I have to think objectively, there was a reality to it. There was the good old days for several reasons. First, we were in a growth phase. Science was growing throughout the country. Scientific budgets were growing throughout the country. Okay? Don't forget, Sputnik had a powerful effect on that. And the materials laboratories were a new experiment with a beautiful idea. Okay? And we were publishing like crazy, learning lots of new things, okay? And getting to meet people we never met before. And above all, our students were relatively well protected. If I put in a proposal for a student support and got that support, I was pretty well assured that they would support him right through to his PhD. Okay.
Perhaps one of the, as far as I know, one of the purposes of the ARPA grant was to produce enough
students,
PhDs. With,
exactly. Yeah. That was as important to, in their minds as the research production. And of course we succeeded in that. And one reason we succeeded is because they protected the student education for 4 years.
So it seems that all the stars aligned at that time, that you had plenty of money, the size was small enough to warrant informal interaction among all the faculty members.
Yeah.
Which are not exactly what science administrators face nowadays, right? They're always worrying about the lack of funding, and the size has grown
well,
to
you know what?
Extent that...
At the time, we wanted more money. We were worrying about the lack of funding. But it was a different kind of thing than it is now, because in truth, there was money. And if you had something really good to propose, you always could get money. But we always wanted more. It's the nature of the beast. Education and research and medicine, I think also, are three areas in which no matter what you do, you can always do it better. No matter how good an education you could deliver, you could find ways to improve it. No matter how great your research establishment, you could find ways to make it better and make it more efficient. No matter what disease you cure, there's always another one to cure, and you could do better on the ones you've got to handle. So the demand for funds in those kinds of fields will never stop, no matter how much you get. So we had money to support our group, to support our students, and so on. Right? But says, you know what? If I had a 25% increase, I could get two more students to come here. Why can't you give me a 25% increase? But it was not a case of misery. It was not a case of bitterness. It was a case of you want to do more. And that's never going to change. The model, I think, as you so rightly said, was a coalescence of factors that made it possible to look back now, and indeed they were the good old days. The LRSM director today has very little money to spend. There's no faculty member that I know of that is supported completely by LRSM funds today. No matter who they are, the LRSM support is a minor percentage of their funding. And when I was there, it was a major part of their funding. And in fact, many people was total part of their funding, which makes life much easier. Estimates have been made that the amount of time that is spent by academic scientists in administering science, by which it means writing proposals, writing reports, making presentations, doing reviews, and so on, is 25 to 33%. Now think of that. A quarter to a third of our time is spending doing things about science that have nothing to do with science. If that system was streamlined, we could immediately increase the scientific productivity of this country by at least 25%. We had a streamlined system in the early days.
And somehow it was lost in due course. In your view, so the streamlined system, in a way, deteriorated over time.
But it's very natural. Programs like this are often, in some factors and in some ways, victims of their own success. When you get to be big and there's big money involved, Congress requires more accountability. And the congressional version of accountability is much more detailed than what our version might be. Okay. Then, when you see successes like MIT and Penn and Cornell and Columbia, other people want some of that too. So you get proposals for new centers. And they have to respond to that somehow. So there's more administration. The NSF, for example, has to go to Congress and justify their budget. They've got to justify budgets for the materials labs they have today, and they've got to go in there by telling them stuff. Where do they get that? They get that from professors writing it up, and they get instructions. Do you have any nuggets, which was a favorite term? And these guys run around for nuggets. Then we have to have an audit. They come down and give an audit, and all of the files are opened up. They look at it very, very carefully because they have to know where the money's been going. So the deterioration is very natural. In our view, it's deterioration. In their view, it's an improvement in accountability. And so competition, large budgets, accountability, political factors, they have an effect on the system.
And all these tend to go hand in hand.
Yeah. And we, what had an effect on our system? The Navy's need for materials, the recognition in the government that materials are important for defense, Sputnik, growing budgets, economic boom times, okay? The idea that science was going to be the cure-all, which of course it never is. But all those things came together and said, we got to do something. For 20 years, it had a wonderful run, didn't it? And the system was built in such a way that now it accommodates pretty well to the tougher system, although at a cost of time. But our department and material science at Penn is thriving. It had its seeds and origins in the early days. What else can I say? I think that I'm enthusiastic about it, probably because it made my career, right? I came here, I was happy, I was doing what I liked. And so some other people might look at it a different way.
Okay, so I'm just looking at your CV here. So you're a director of the LRSM for 2-3 years until 69. Then you became chair of the department in 72. So you were moving in and out of these offices.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Cause the
I'm not sure why.
So the chair, the department chair's offices in that corner, and the director's offices
downstairs. Right. And but not a heavy move.
Right. Yeah. And you became associate dean of the engineering and applied science.
Right.
Right after that, the vice provost.
In those days, Joe and I worked closely together. He was associate dean for undergraduate. Bordogna.
And then you occupied the position that Hofstetter had
right.
for a while. So you're right that your career spans this 20-year, well, the height of your career is past that 20-year period where
right.
that all these wonderful ideas about science and wonderful funding resource available, which was not the case after the 1980s.
That's right.
Which was characterized by intense international competition, worries about competitiveness,
right.
Misgivings about whether all these fundamental research funding is going to
exactly.
right use,
yeah.
And whether we should do more practical research mm-hmm. than basic.
Even before then, many industrial labs had closed down. Remember, U.S. Steel had essentially closed down. GE had cut way back. Okay. Ford Motor Company.
And then in the 21st century, as the nanotechnology boom happened, partly as a result of that post-1980 period, try to regain this leadership position for the U.S. scientific community. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that there is this continuation of practice that goes back to the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And even as they are aiming for slightly different goals, the institutional framework itself has remained.
Isn't that interesting?
Constant.
Yeah. Well, it was a good idea.
Yeah.
And both good ideas and bad ideas could persist for a long time, but this was a pretty good one.
So were you at all involved in the NBIC, the Nanobio Interface Center?
Not really. I wasn't involved in any organizational part of it. I've done a lot of research on nanotubes. I worked out a lot of statistical mechanics of molecules inside nanotubes and worked out the energetics and interactions of that. And I published a lot of that stuff. Right now, only peripherally involved. I'm doing some research with a colleague on metals inside of nanotubes, but I'm going to be 80 years old. The young people have the energy and the ideas.
So how does that all work together? Say, Dawn Bonnell, for example, right? She's the director of the NBIC.
Mm-hmm.
She's a member of the LRSN.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a faculty member at the Department of Materials Science Engineering, which seems like a very complex organizational network that is
Why?
Like superimposed at the same time.
Well, there are, you know, a Penn, I guess, like other places, has both horizontal and vertical organizations, right? I mean, if you're going to do interdisciplinary work, you've got to organize with people across boundaries. That's what the institute does. Penn is somewhat different than many other universities, especially it used to be more true than now because other universities are catching up. But Penn has been kind of entrepreneurial. Most of the good things that happened at Penn were did by some faculty member going out and being an entrepreneur, both in an academic sense and in a financial sense. The major reason being that Penn had such a small endowment. So if somebody wanted to do something, they had to go raise money and find people to do it. So there was an atmosphere at Penn that faculty members had to do things for themselves. And that's still true. And so Dawn went out and essentially she was the fireball that did it. Dave Luzzi was a fireball that did that other one with the financed by the state. Okay, he's left us now, as you know, Dean, or Northeastern, I forgot. But the individuals, faculty members, are usually the driving force between new initiatives. Okay? It's not usual that. It comes from some administrator. I've been involved in several of these. That's it?
Good.
Okay. Well, I wish you luck.
Well, thank you very much.
I also ask you to send me a copy of your write-up.
Oh, sure.